We have with us live in the studios once again, Jav Parrish and Maria Tomchik, both with Eat This Steak. Good morning.
Good morning.
Morning.
All right. A full plate we have in front of us.
Yes. Happy dining.
Yum, yum. Let's start out with a couple of city council items and building heights in South Lake Union.
Yeah, this week the city council okayed building a rezone in South Lake Union that would take building heights up to 40 stories in the areas just north of Denny Way. Now, what was interesting about this to me is that they went ahead and said, we got to be in a rush to approve the rezone, so we're going to put off a few things that we can agree on. And it turns out these things are some of the most important aspects of the rezone that they should have decided on, one of them being the fees that the city would charge for developers to pay in exchange for building taller buildings. Those fees would go, of course, for affordable housing. They put that off. They said, oh no, we're not going to decide on that today.
And the definition of affordable is also up for grabs.
And
whether the city should be getting fees or whether they should be paying fees to developers. Vulcan has a memo out to them too.
And then they put off a couple of other things too, like deciding on the height of buildings that would be built along Lake Union, which directly impacts some of Vulcan's properties. And they also delayed...
As well as the property value of the buildings.
Oh, yeah, of the buildings in the whole area. And also, they put off the decision on how to preserve views of the Space Needle, all of these things being what you would think to be pretty core questions to a South Lake Union rezone. But there's some dissension on the city council. I suppose that's a good thing, to see some dissension on these controversial issues. It would be nice, however, to see more discussion, particularly public discussion, and a decision on some of them.
Well, there's been plenty of discussion in Vulcan's boardroom.
Oh, I'm sure.
As you know, what happens in Vulcan's boardroom stays in the city council. Mm-hmm. So. They went ahead and pushed it through, and then when nobody is looking, they'll probably issue some executive parameters around those decisions that would probably annoy a lot of people.
Yeah,
we'll see.
All right. Well, speaking of people looking, there was a proposal out this week for surveillance equipment.
Yeah, the city council committee that's looking at this issue, they are considering adopting some rules for the purchase and use of surveillance equipment by the city's departments, and that includes the Seattle Police Department, which has gotten caught with their hand in the cookie jar in terms of having purchased unmanned aerial drones that they were going to put into use, but have since been told to sideline, at least for the next 2 years, and also putting up some cameras along the waterfront and a couple of cameras in other places downtown, and not having a policy in place first of all, not asking the city council if it was okay to buy those and put those up, and not having a policy in place for how to use them, how the data is going to be collected and stored, and who's going to have access to that data. Now, that's what these rules are supposed to address, those issues.
There's also the issue that it was originally intended for, it's a Homeland Security grant around port security,
yeah.
And yet SPD has said very clearly, well, we're going to use this to prosecute ordinary crime as well. So it raises the question of what other uses it's going to have.
Yeah, and so the city council took some public testimony during one of their hearings this week, and about a dozen people got up and testified. Members of the public requested some additions to the rules, like protections regarding who would have access to that data, and the right for citizens to sue the government if the data that's collected from those cameras or from unmanned aerial drones is misused in some way. And that, of course, would be the main strong deterrent against any city department like the Seattle Police Department actually supposedly misusing or, you know, putting something like cameras or unmanned aerial drones to a use that is not pre-specified by the city council.
I believe the city council actually did okay initially the purchase of the waterfront cameras, and they just didn't look into it.
They just didn't. Yeah. It was it sounded to me like it was a rubber stamp. They didn't really review it. Yeah. Didn't really critique it.
It was a budget line item basically that they didn't really pay attention to.
Yeah.
All right. Okay, anything else on that?
Nope.
Okay, still related to the Seattle police, the plan out this week for monitoring them?
Yeah, this week the court-appointed monitor, Merrick Bobb, who's overseeing the Seattle Police Department and Department of Justice agreement, submitted his monitoring plan to the court on Tuesday. And it came as a little bit of a surprise because apparently Mayor McGinn thought that he would have final say over what plan the monitor was going to submit, even though, of course, he himself is not the monitor. The monitoring plan, which Bob submitted, I just want to read a quote to you. It says, quote, "The purpose of the monitoring plan is to establish clear expectations for the city and DOJ on how the monitor will assess compliance with the settlement agreement." So it basically tells you right there what the monitor's role is. The monitor and the monitoring plan are supposed to be overseeing the whole process.
And that is not something that Mayor McGinn or any other city official has jurisdiction over.
Right. And they're supposed to be setting the deadlines. They're going to adopt the different measurements of and assessments, and they're going to set a schedule based on a proposed schedule that they got from the Seattle Police Department on how all of these reforms are going to take place and when. Now, the report says in multiple places that the monitoring plan does not expand on the settlement agreement. So it doesn't add anything in addition to the agreement that was reached between the DOJ and the city, you know, in front of the court. Now, the problem is in how you interpret the settlement agreement. And Chief Diaz, the Seattle Police Department Chief Diaz, and Mayor McGinn have a very narrow interpretation of the agreement. Now, in several places in the monitoring plan, it says that it refers to biased policing and bias-free policing. Now, Mayor McGinn and Chief Diaz insist that the DOJ did not find that the Seattle Police Department was guilty of biased policing. However, that's not strictly true. What the DOJ did find is that there was very strong evidence that there could be biased policing going on at the Seattle Police Department. However, the Seattle Police Department was deficient in collecting data on that. And what Merrick Bobb is saying in this monitoring plan is that, okay, you guys have a problem with the community, and you need to start putting these measurements in place, and you need to start training your officers on bias-free policing, and you need to address that issue. And that's some of the stuff that the SPD, Chief Diaz, and Mayor McGinn are protesting.
And, you know, even if there were not widespread anecdotal evidence, as well as a widespread belief in segments of the community that this is a problem, those are best practices anyway.
Yes.
So it does raise the question of why SPD and why Mayor McGinn are so resistant to this when it's what any competent urban mm-hmm. police department should be doing.
And that's the language in the monitoring plan says. It says it's really saying, you know, these are things that should be in place, and what we're looking at is trying to amend some of these deficiencies at the SPD, including some things that might run afoul of the police union. Like there's a section in the monitoring plan saying you guys need to hire more sergeants and more lieutenants to oversee the rank and file. And now the police union may have something to say about that. You know, an increased supervision of the rank and file is something that the police union definitely has a strong interest in. But at the same time, the monitoring plan has wording to the effect that any agreements between the police union and the city should not supersede or should not invalidate any portions of the settlement agreement or the monitoring plan.
Which is a really key segment because in the past, the city of Seattle has used its contract negotiations with the Police Officers Guild as an excuse for not implementing reforms. Well, we can't get this past the union when it doesn't even ask the union in the first place, and when it has an enormous amount of leverage over the union. that it chooses not to use.
Yeah, time and time again, when the community has demanded more public oversight of the police department and beefing up the like the OPA and various boards that might oversee use of force issues and biased policing, the SPD has come back and said, well, according to our agreement with the union, you know. And that's, and what Merrick Bob is saying, look, you gotta set that aside.
Yeah. And we're gonna see that again. The city council is about to approve the, community police commission that was also set out in this agreement, which has 15 members, several of whom are very good activists from the community. There's somebody from the LCCW of Washington, Youth Undoing Institutional Racism, the ED of the Downtown Emergency Services Center, but there's also four members of law enforcement in the justice system, which is not really the community per se. They have a vested interest already in these policies, and several politicians. So the question again is, will the representatives of the actual community that are impacted by these practices be listened to, or will they simply be shunted aside and patted on the head and said, we know you have these concerns, but you just don't understand how law enforcement works? And that has been the rationale that has been used to avoid accountability for a very long time.
Mm-hmm. All right. Moving over to the east side of the mountains, Hanford, more bad news coming out of there?
Yeah, well, kind of. Actually, it's somewhat good news, in addition to all the leaking tanks that have been discovered over the past couple weeks. The Department of Energy did, however, agree this week to ship some radioactive waste to New Mexico rather than waiting for a long-delayed treatment plant that's supposed to be built at Hanford. But, and you knew that there was a but, the 7,500 to 30,000 drums of transuranic radioactive waste that would ostensibly go to New Mexico's Waste Isolation Pilot Project, WIP, requires, first of all, a modified permit to ship the waste. That does not exist yet. And it also requires the state of New Mexico to agree to accept the waste, which it it actually has no particular incentive to do. And even if both those things fall into place, it's another 2 to 4 year process to actually begin to start shipping the material. So the DOE approval is in place, but unless Governor Inslee and the tri-party agreement and environmental activists and so forth keep pushing for this, you know, we're still going to have that waste sitting in Hanford in unsafe storage, in addition to all the tank problems that have surfaced this past month.
Well, yeah, and I don't know where they'll get the money for it, because based on the sequestration, they already announced this week that they're cutting back $92 million for cleanup. So
yes, and yeah. That's been one of the first places that money's been cut repeatedly over the last 20 years, which is, as there have been various budget crises over the years, which is one of the major reasons why cleanup is so far behind schedule.
All right. Let's move on. A investigation with the Seattle Public Schools.
Yeah, very similar to what happened with the Department of Justice and SPD. Now we have the Federal Department of Education investigating the Seattle School District, in this case for disproportionate disciplining of black students as opposed to white students at the high school and middle school level. In the 2011-12 school year, the numbers actually are pretty astonishing, and similar to what it's been in past years. At high schools, nearly 13% of black high school students in Seattle received at least one short-term suspension, as opposed to under 4% of white students. In middle schools, it's 7% for white students and 27% for black students. Those numbers for African American students are much, much higher than in similarly sized urban areas, even though compared to other urban school districts around the country, Seattle is relatively wealthier, has relatively lower rates of both poverty and crime. So you can't really pin it on circumstances or culture or whatever. It very much does come back to the school district.
Poverty or factors within the community.
Yeah, exactly. It very much does come back to the school district. And there's a priceless quote in the PI article on this week that, quote, the district has long been aware of this disparity. Well, that kind of raises an obvious question. Why not do something about it?
Yeah.
It's not like this is something that the district is helpless to prevent, since it is district administrators that are enacting these disparate discipline rates. So it'll be very interesting to see what comes from the Department of Education investigation into this, whether, for example, the Seattle School District has in fact been keeping adequate records to establish a pattern of bias, for example.
Yeah. One of the interesting things about this is the attitude of the new superintendent Banda. If you contrast his attitude versus the attitude of Mayor Mike McGinn and Chief of Police Diaz, you see a big difference there. Banda came out and said, well, yes, I understand this is a big problem. I'm new here and I really want to work with the feds on this to try to fix this problem. And then on the other side, we have Mayor McGinn and Chief Diaz denying that there's a problem of biased policing and they don't want to work with the feds. In fact, it seems that they're doing they're working their hardest to try to slow things down.
Yeah, the difference there is it's a little bit different internal political dynamic with, mm-hmm. with those two institutions, because with the Seattle School District, the problem often hasn't been with these kind of issues with either the superintendent or the school board. It's been with the
with
staff that tends to
individual schools. Yeah.
Well, not just individual schools, uh-huh. but also central district staff,
yeah.
Which tend to run the place because board members come and go.
Yeah.
Certainly in recent years, superintendents have come and gone, and they are very dependent on lower and middle level administrative staff to set these policies and monitor these kind of issues. And at that level, the Seattle School District has a long, long history of being very contemptuous of parent and community standards. Mm-hmm. And that's why issues like this can drag on.
All right. Let's move on to national, starting with Arkansas and abortion ban.
Yeah, the Arkansas legislature voted this week to ban abortions at later than 12 weeks. So they set the new limit for women at 12 weeks. That is patently unconstitutional. Democratic governor
and designed to draw a Supreme Court
yeah.
case.
And the Democratic governor Mike Beebe tried to veto it, but Republicans, with the help of many Democrats, overrode his veto. Now, the limit was established by the Supreme Court, is 24 weeks. That's about 6 months. So that's your first two trimesters. The ACLU and the Center for Reproductive Rights have said that they will file a suit in federal court to try to block the law from taking effect. And even anti-abortion activists have said that they hate this law because it's so clearly unconstitutional that it could lead the courts to validate the 24-week standard. We will just have to see if that's the case.
Yeah, and you know, for anybody who's in doubt about that, 12 weeks, which is slightly less than 3 months. That's less than the first trimester. It is a period of, and particularly in a state where there's very few abortion providers. And those abortion providers tend to be in the handful of cities in Arkansas, not in most of the counties mm-hmm. of the state. So by the time you actually discover that you're pregnant, come to what is for most women an extremely difficult decision and make arrangements often to have to travel as well and find the money, you're going to run out of time. And that's exactly what this law is intended to target.
Yeah. And currently there are two laws being challenged in court that changed the limit from 24 weeks to 20 weeks. Both Arizona and Georgia had passed laws that are currently being challenged in the court. And then this week on Wednesday, a federal judge ruled that Idaho's 20-week law is unconstitutional. So it seems very clear that this new Arkansas law will be overthrown. But in the meantime, it's going to set some serious limits for women in the state.
All right, moving on. Confirmation hearing this week for a new director for the CIA.
Yes, Mr. Brennan, also known as a war criminal on any number of counts, was in fact confirmed as the new director of the CIA, John Brennan, and an unapologetic advocate of torture during his time in the Bush administration, and somebody who. Quite frankly, should be behind bars rather than holding the highest office directing what in many cases historically has been in a department that runs a lot of already illegal operations.
And this comes at the same week that the Senate Intelligence Committee issued a study, but they did not release it to the public, of the Bush administration's enhanced interrogation techniques, which have continued under the Obama administration. And what the report says, we don't know for sure because there's not a copy available for the public, although there are people who have read it and and have talked about it in the press, that the program was ill-conceived, sloppily managed, and not effective in collecting any information that led to any serious capture or killing of terrorists.
And although that is an argument often made by advocates for torture, it's really irrelevant because under both domestic and international law, it's grossly illegal, whether people just...
Whether you believe it's effective or not.
Yeah. So we had Mr. Brennan this week taking the oath of office on a draft copy of the Constitution that does not include the Bill of Rights. It was interesting to note. But we also had a dust-up during the confirmation process where Libertarian Republican Senator Rand Paul of Kentucky sent a letter to Attorney General Eric Holder asking if the CIA, which has become much more of a military organization post 9/11 and is primarily responsible at this point for a lot of the drone activities that we see, not only could drones be used to kill American citizens overseas, which the Obama administration has already advocated, but could also execute them without any kind of due process, at least due process outside the executive branch, on American soil as well. And Holder wrote back and said, "Well, no, that would take really extraordinary circumstances, which we don't ever foresee, and this would never be anything that would actually happen. But yeah, as a matter of fact, I guess we could do that, sure." Exactly. It's like, you know, we've talked about with Denis Kucinich in this point, and it's even more true with Rand Paul, right issue, wrong spokesperson. Mm-hmm. So Rand Paul, goes on a sort of a ridiculous 13-hour filibuster in the Senate, which did, however, have the desired effect of bringing this issue more into mainstream news coverage. Paul was talking about, what if they target, grandma, walking her dog and having coffee at a cafe in Houston? No, that's not what's going to happen. What's more likely to happen is they will target, gullible Muslim teenagers that they have sucked into thinking that they might have some fantasy jihad going on, or dissenters who oppose one or another government policy. And that the issues with all of this is not whether you trust Barack Obama or not, it's whether you trust any president, of any politics and any party. Because once you have both Republicans and Democrats signing off on this policy, it becomes precedent. And that's the problem also with John Brennan serving under both parties now, and somebody like him who has grossly violated domestic international law, being confirmed in a bipartisan nature by the Senate to another high office after that. It sets as a precedent and is something that is uncontroversial, policies which are not just highly controversial, but beyond the pale.
All right. On to a couple economic items, starting with the New York Times.
Yeah, the New York Times had an interesting article on Monday. The title of it was "Corporate Profits Soar as Worker Income Limps."
I'm shocked. Shocked I am.
I know. A lot of people have been hearing the economic happy talk or reading the economic happy talk in the press about how the Dow is up and unemployment is down and corporate profits are at record highs. And they're scratching their heads and asking, well, if that's the case, then why does it still seem like times are tough for me and my friends and average Americans? Well, the truth is times are still tough for average Americans, and there are some reasons for that. And this article was a very good example of why that is. And it really pointed out that corporate profits are at record highs, and it does not have a whole lot to do with how the economy is going for average Americans. In the third quarter of 2012, corporate profits were 14.2% of all national income, and that's the largest share since 1950. On the other hand, employees' share of profits, people who take home a wage, was only 61.7% of all national income. That's the lowest level since 1966. Corporate earnings have risen 20% per year since the end of 2008, which was the beginning of the current recession. Average Americans' disposable income grew only a tiny 1.4% each year since then. So if you compare the two, 20% for corporations every year an additional 20% to their income. And for average Americans who take home a wage, a little under 1.5%.
Which is less than the rate of inflation.
Yes, it's lower than inflation. That's telling you what the trend is. And of course, the big word behind that is productivity. That article had an interesting quote. One corporate CEO said, "There's no doubt we will continue to drive productivity year after year." Productivity being, of course, trying to get more hours out of each worker. And I saw that quote and I thought, oh yes, you will drive productivity, sure, with a whip if you have to.
And more drive and more hours out of fewer workers.
Yes.
All right. Also out this week, a study related to income tax.
Yeah, the Institute on Taxation and Economic Policy had a study out on the economies of the 9 states, including Washington State, that do not have a state personal income tax, versus the economies of the 9 states with the highest income tax rates and all 41 income tax states as a whole, and found that the 9 states without an income tax, including Washington, underperformed both the economies of the highest rate states and all the 41 income tax states overall. Over the past decade, real per capita GDP growth only 5.2% in the non-income tax states, 8.2%, that's more than 50% more in the 9 highest tax states, and the real median household income also fell further in the non-income tax states than the other states, while unemployment statistics are very similar across all 3 groups.
Yeah.
What this tells you is that the argument against an income tax, that it would cut into the economy, that it would be a disincentive to businesses and so forth,
businesses
is simply factually not true.
It's just not true.
All right. That only leaves us a couple minutes left for international.
Yeah. There was another New York Times article this week called U.S. Weighs Risks and Motives of Hacking by China or Iran, in which they talked a little bit about hacking from China and from potentially from Iran. And really reading the article, reading between the lines of the article, you come to the conclusion that I've come to, which is China doesn't really want and can't afford to sabotage our infrastructure with cyber attacks because China owns most of America and owns most of the American public debt. And by sabotaging our infrastructure, they would never get repaid. And what Chinese hackers are really doing is they're trying to steal corporate secrets so that they can compete in the marketplace. Iran, on the other hand, just doesn't have the technology and skills to do real damage to us. So in the end, this whole talk about we need to pour a whole bunch of public money into cyber command at the Pentagon in order to protect us from cyber attacks is really just more corporate welfare to protect corporate to protect American corporations from Chinese hackers stealing their secrets.
And what's left out of all those accounts is that neither China nor Iran started their cyber hacking programs until after the United States had already attacked both countries.
Yeah, last week Symantec said, the online security company said that they had found evidence that that a beta version, an early version of the Stuxnet virus was released into the wild in 2005, which was long before we've been hearing anything about Chinese cyber hacking.
All right. Well, unfortunately, that doesn't leave us any time but for events.
Yeah, several events going on. A whole lot of new documentaries coming out this week. On Monday night, March 11th at 7:30, the Northwest Film Forum is doing a screening of the new documentary, Who Bombed Judy Berry? For folks who remember back to the early 90s and the Redwood Summer and the Redwood Wars, Judy Berry, a very well-known IWW labor and environmental activist, she and Daryl Chaney had their car bombed while they were in Oakland, California. Chaney and Earth First co-founder Mike Rozell and the director and producer will be on hand for a Q&A. That'll be Monday night at 7:30 at the Northwest Film Forum up on 12th Avenue on Capitol Hill, 151512. That is $10 for general admission and $6 for Film Forum members. On Wednesday night, there will be a screening and community discussion of the new documentary Cracking the Codes, the System of Racial Inequity. That will be at Seattle University, Campion Hall, $18 general admission, $5 student. That from 6:30 to 9:30 on Wednesday. And on Thursday night, the 14th, from 7 to 9 o'clock, o'clock screening and discussion of The House I Live In, the 2012 very good documentary in the war on drugs. That'll be at the Common Good Cafe at the University of Temple United Methodist Church at 43rd and 15th Northeast in the U District. Also at U Temple on Tuesday night, March 12th from 7 to 9 o'clock, the talk Still Think Christian Fascism is Dead. That is a rhetorical question, of course. The speaker will be Barry Lynn. He's the Executive Director of Americans United for Separation of Church and State. That ought to be a great talk. That, again, at University of Temple United Methodist Church, 43rd and 15th Northeast in the U District on Tuesday evening.
Talking as we do every week with Jav Parrish and Maria Tomchik, both with Eat the State. Where do people find Eat the State?
www.eatthestate.org.
And you can find some of my back articles at mariatomchik.com.